Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Michael Mascarenhas, the editor of Lessons in Environmental Justice, From Civil Rights to Black Lives Matter and Idle No More, published this year by SAGE. Dr. Mascarenhas, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
No problem. To start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background, including how you came to be working on the area of environmental justice and what inspired you to put together this book?
Oh, that's a big question. I'd say I'm a sort of first generation person of color and really sort of from a very young age been sort of aware of inequities in the environment, you know, places where I lived, even where I worked, these have always been sort of front and center for me. And there have been challenges and sort of presented barriers for me in life. And so I think when I started to become educated and you know, taking my undergraduate degrees in environmental science and then my master's, I was always interested in questions of justice and access and the distribution of natural resources. And so this sort of became really kind of a natural path for me to finish up a PhD in sociology and then, you know, really look at issues of equity around water and water justice. That's really been my area of interest. And, you know, my PhD was looking at indigenous communities in southwestern Ontario. It's close to where I'm from, and really looking at neoliberal policies and how that has it impacted not only their sort of sovereignty and decision making sort of authority over natural resources, but also their health and welfare as well. And I really became interested again in issues of water distribution. So I wrote another book looking at water welfare, in other words, how people get access to water in sort of the, what we call the developing world. It became, you know, quite obvious to me that many people in the so-called developing world really get their water through humanitarian efforts at some level, and that what I call new humanitarianism has a particular kind of formation, if you will. Many nonprofits are large. Many nonprofits take donations from large corporations to provide goods and services to people who need that. But that also sets them up to kind of navigate some tricky waters. And so I was looking at how and what the conditions of water service was in certain areas. And, you know, my last book is really looking at Flint and Detroit and Michigan more generally and austerity and the way in which austerity is really austerity is really being it's a policy that is disproportionately harming communities of color around public health services and access to basic rights like water. in part because these decisions I'm making are being made strictly around financial or economic decisions, which tend to harm people who are poor, and those disproportionately are people of color. And so that leads me to this kind of book on this edited book on environmental justice. And it's a burgeoning field over the last 30 years or so. And I really wanted, and it's also a topic of particular interest for a lot of people. And I wanted to present a piece of scholarship that was a collaborative effort that provided students in particular, but people who were trying to access the field, with entry points that were accessible, that sort of, if you will, broke down the kind of complex history and of the field and made it accessible to people.
So, this is, as I think we mentioned, an edited volume. So you've got a lot of other folks writing the chapters here. And in the introduction, you describe the assembling of this set of contributors as sort of an act of justice within academia itself. So I was hoping you could say a little more about how you selected your contributors and, you know, what you were hoping to accomplish by putting together the particular set of people that you got to write for this book.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I wanted to change, to some extent, the people that were speaking about this field to the extent that I could. I spent a lot of time thinking about who would be a part of this volume. I wanted scholars of color. I wanted it to be represented in terms of gender. And I wanted also, in particular, I wanted to have folks who have not been heard of. So Indigenous scholars, for example, was one I really wanted to make sure we had representation in the book. So, you know, the book is sort of, the introduction is by Bob Bullard. Many people see him as a sort of father of environmental justice. And I thought that was sort of fitting that he did lead the book. But I also wanted this book to be an opportunity for new scholars who were presenting kind of new theories or new methods on how to understand environmental justice outcomes. And in that sense, we have Sarah Rijos, for example, Christina Ferreira, who are newer scholars, but looking at air pollution and conditions in prisons in kind of new and novel ways. So I really wanted to make sure that we weren't just hearing from academics. We were hearing from scholar activists that were passionate, that were and changing how we thought about this discipline. I also wanted to make this book have a pedagogical purpose. And so I asked we asked all of the contributors to think about exercises, teaching exercises that might help explain or demonstrate the type of theories they're trying to advance. And so each chapter sort of has this little, a few questions, which really, I think, encourage students to do some, you know, their an exercise that might help them explain these theories being presented.
Great. And you actually just kind of touched on the next few questions that I have here to ask. So that's good. So, to ask you to go into a little more detail on a few things. First, like you said, you've got a range of contributors from people who were part of environmental justice scholarship right from the beginning to, newly emerging folks, and our conceptions of what environmental justice is have evolved over the years. So could you say a little more about how environmental justice is being conceptualized and theorized in your book, and the kind of balance between the different points of view that different people are bringing to it versus, you know, having a kind of a coherent book?
Right. That's a good question too. There's a sort of general, I think, acceptance that, you know, environmental justice really comes out of a combination of sort of the civil rights movement and the anti-toxics campaign in the 60s and 70s. And I think that historical kind of beginning is there's certainly a lot of sort of truth to that. One of the ways in which the movement has really expanded in terms of thinking about, you know, what exactly is justice? Is it distributive justice? Is it procedural? You know, can we talk about that corrective aspects of justice as well? Historically, also, EJ has really tried to correlate, let's say, disproportionality. So, an example, a toxic waste site and its location to particular groups of people, so people of color. And the idea is to sort of prove methodologically disproportionality. And then with the intention to sort of lobby government for more fairer laws in these types of communities. And that's been tremendously successful. It's created environmental legislation at the federal level, at state levels as well. But what we're seeing also is there's certainly a limit to that sort of approach. One, it kind of looks, you know, at environmental justice outcomes, like the sightings, let's say, of toxic waste sites or the spills of dangerous chemicals as accidents. And some of them may be simply accidents. But, you know, we're increasingly seeing the role of the state, whether through deregulation or not policing toxic polluters, as actually being implicated in creating unjust situations. And so, you know, when activists are putting this data together and showing that they're harmed, but when the state is also involved in this, who do people go to? And so what, you know, environmental justice thinkers are actually trying to push a little bit more, I think, is to look at things like racial capitalism, or to look at a government as an active agent in environmental justice outcomes. And so work is sort of being advanced in that sense to what we say to be more critical, to look at the role of states and institutions, to look at the role of business, to look at the role of government and federal policies as well, and to think about this environmental justice as not simply an outcome, but as a racial formation that continues to harm people of color, predominantly, and poor people as well. And that, that's a more critical way of thinking about EJ. And I think it's a really important direction that the scholarship and research is taking.
Great. So then to go back to another point that you've already kind of touched on, you said that you designed this book in part as a book that could be used in the classroom. And I found out about it because the day after our spring schedules were published and I'm on the schedule to teach an EJ class, your publisher emailed me, you know, pitching the book as a course text. And in some of our conversation before we recorded, you mentioned that you've been using this book in your own teaching. So could you tell us more about how the book has been working in a classroom setting for students that may have, you know, not a lot of exposure to at least the academic aspect of environmental justice?
Well, the book is actually, when you put these things together and you make a call to authors and, you don't know what the finished product's going to be. And I've been on lots of sort of collaborative efforts, and I'm really happy with how this book has turned out. I think the chapters, all of them, are very succinct. They're very informative and they're very accessible, and it works well with the kind of classroom pace, if you will. You know, the students are reading 10 to 12 pages per class, and the information, you know, we spent a lot of time editing the book to make sure that the information was, again, accessible, but not sort of, but not cutting things that didn't matter. And I think what we've done is we've really successfully shown like multiple different ways of thinking about environmental injustice. So we talk about environments of injustice. You know, we introduce students to the concept and how it's been framed in the past. We talk about methodology and methodological debates. There's a few chapters on the regulatory apparatus of the state and the way in which that has played a role in environmental justice in the country. And then we look at particular types of cases. And I think the case study approach is really informative in terms of how students are coming to understand environmental justice. You know, it's where we work, where we play, where we're housed, but it's also things like where we pray and, you know, where people are incarcerated. And so we're expanding this notion of thinking about environments that we inhabit every day. And I think that's been really, really informative for them. So, you know, we just finished a chapter on the criminal justice system and how that plays a role, particularly today, where, you know, we have in a kind of era of colorblind racism. And so we spent a lot of time sort of making sure particular theories are introduced and introduced in a way that's very accessible through kind of these, you know, particular case studies. And it's really been, I found teaching this book really satisfying. I think, you know, the students are having, are becoming really interested in the areas. They're kind of asking really informative questions. I think for many of them, this is really an eye-opening experience. Like, they didn't really think about all of these different ways in which people have uneven experiences. And I think so we've been really, really happy with how the book has been played out. So, yeah, I hope you'll have the same experience.
Awesome. Yeah. And so the book is designed with a classroom in mind, but it's not just like a textbook, you know, it's not just for students. So could you say a bit about, for someone who's not teaching an environmental justice course, but is, you know, interested in the topic, you know, what's the value that they'll get out of reading this book?
I think for someone who is just interested in this, I think what the book, as a sort of subject matter, I think what the book does is it provides them with entry points. It provides them with a historical analysis or that helps them, that introduces, you know, what sort of introduces some of the theoretical concepts in a way that's accessible. I think that's the biggest contribution to this book. You know, it also makes connections that aren't, that are hard, difficult to make. So, you know, in the beginning of the book, we sort of really draw a historical kind of pattern from this kind of civil rights and the anti-toxic campaigns to Black Lives Matter and Idle No More, to help people see that, you know, what we're seeing on the streets today, the kind of protests that people are engaged in today, is not something new. There's a particularity to it that the book, I think, points out to, but also to see this in its historical context. And I think that's really important. contribution that the book makes. That this notion of environmental justice as a kind of growing and continuing struggle that scholars are trying to understand and activists are actively engaged in. And it's the movement, I think, that this book captures quite well.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and that was something I noticed as well. It's, you know, right there in your subtitle where you mentioned some of these movements and you say some of the contributors that you've got are scholar activists, not just scholars. So I wanted to see if you could say a little more about what you see as the relationship between scholars and academia working on EJ topics and activist movements that are kind of out on the front lines fighting on these issues.
So the relationship between the two, I think there is, I would say there's quite often a disconnect between kind of activists and scholars trying to write this stuff. So, you know, for me, there are the academics who don't sort of immerse themselves in the lived condition sort of miss the nuances regarding how environmental justice actually plays out in some of these communities. And so there's been a there has been a tendency to armchair theorize in this field and in other fields as well. And, you know, that to some extent silences the voices of activists. It also tends to be, it doesn't capture the nuance of some of these movements. And I think what scholar activists are trying to do is to not simply understand what's going on in these communities. That's important. But they're also trying to empower these communities. And that, in many ways, is sort of the shoe that sort of, I think, dropped in the environmental justice movement. When you think about what Martin Luther King Jr. and others, who other sort of pioneers in the civil rights movement, were really talking about not only, making sure that people had economic and political rights, but that equity was actually served. Empowerment was given back to the communities. And I think scholar activists really work on that last piece to not only capture and understand this for public consumption and academic theories, but to also instill or to cultivate partnerships that will move environmental justice fights forward. And I think that's the really important aspect of that. That type of work, the scholar activist work, does take time. I mean, I have been writing and interviewing people and being, actually being in Flint and Detroit since 2014. And I'm still writing, 6 years later about this stuff. So the scholar activist kind of work takes time, and being an academic, you're constantly pushed to publish, and so many of us don't have the luxury of that time, and so that tends to I think, you know, really brush against, you know, the stresses of academia. And so we don't often, you know, get, you know, deep, thick descriptions of movement organization and coalition building and in the way in which we really need to understand how environmental justice plays out. And so that's the real tension between sort of academia and scholar activism, is the really, you know, the demands of academia that sort of don't allow scholars to immerse themselves in communities for extended periods of time to kind of do the work that needs to be done to really help activists move their fights forward.
Yeah, I think that's really, really true. So then moving on to another subject here, I was really interested to see there's a whole section of the book that focuses on methodology in environmental justice research. And that's something that I'm always trying to get my students to understand, is that environmental justice isn't just about learning a set of examples of injustices, but it's also about being able to apply skills in things like GIS or interviewing or other research methods to dealing with real problems. So what do you think are the most important methodological considerations for people working on environmental justice topics these days?
Well, I think what's really interesting, I think, today is the sort of advancements we have that we didn't sort of have at the beginning of the movement. So, you know, you have Python, you have GIS that really, I think, provide students and researchers with new ways to visualize and to demonstrate inequity. You know, there's been this underlying tension of how best to measure inequity, and there are multiple ways to do that. You know, I think what we're trying to understand, and I think what we've done very well, is to sort of correlate or become better, I think, at identifying the right type of unit of analysis to understand certain exposures. So, you know, if we're looking at, say, air exposure, for example, we know pretty well that, you know, something quite close, like a zip code, is probably a really useful unit of analysis. You know, we also know that the way in which these pollutants emit themselves, that we need to also understand that we can't simply use a census tract. We actually have to sort of project how these sorts of chemicals emit themselves. So we might have to, you know, use some sort of contingent method that kind of understands something that's weighted. So we're getting, you know, we're finding out the limits of sort of the way we've done this in the past. And we're also looking at and understanding new types of methods, which I think have been very productive. We're also kind of understanding the limits of kind of the regulatory apparatus as well. So, you know, a lot of things that are emitted are in the air from, let's say, diesel fuel. The particulate matters are so small that they're not actually picked up by the apparatuses that are used, the technologies that are used to measure this stuff. So through the work that we're doing in these communities, we're actually questioning the regulatory standards that are being put in place to assess health outcomes. You know, another interesting thing in the Flint and Detroit case was, a lot of the regulators were saying, well, you know, the water meets government standards. But that wasn't the question that activists were really concerned with. They didn't care whether, you know, there was five parts per billion lead in the water or less. That's the standard. They wanted to know whether their water was safe to drink. And so I think our research is really pushing these ideas around what are the right methodological tools, what are the right units of analysis to understand the exposures that people are experiencing today. And I think we're really pushing those boundaries in important ways. We're not only understanding exposure in terms of, you know, well, exposure to water, exposure to air, exposure to kind of home toxins in the home, but we're also understanding the intersectionality of these, right? So if people are impacted, let's say, in terms of asthma, because they're living close to a refinery or close to a port, we also are understanding that asthma actually means might mean other or might lead to other environmental justices in terms of it might mean that you have to take the days off of work. So you might have a loss of income. Children might miss school. So there might be a lack of learning opportunities. And we're trying to also understand the ways in which exposure to toxins or air, or bad air or bad water are also having intersectional or multiple cumulative impacts. And we're trying to understand that as well in terms of understanding and pushing through or moving forward EJ methodologies.
Great. Yeah, lots more important research that we still need to do on those. So the book has 18 chapters plus the introduction and conclusion. So we're not going to take time to go through every one of them here. But I was hoping you could just kind of whet our listeners' appetite a bit by picking out one or two examples of chapters or things that came up in the book that you found particularly interesting or surprising as an experienced scholar in the field?
Wow, that's a good question. I think, and I unfortunately don't have the book in front of me. what I would say is one of the most interesting things I found about the book is a chapter on Jill Harrison's book, a chapter on the regulatory apparatus, and where she was doing an ethnography of managers at the Environmental Protection Agency, the United States Environmental Protection Agency. And what I, one of the questions I think in the environmental justice community is we've known inequality. We know and we have measured environmental injustices for 40 years now. There's been a strong movement and there's lots of laws at the federal and state level. But we also know that race is still a predictor of where toxic waste sites are located in this country. So we know that in spite of all the information, all of the methodological advances and the theoretical application and environmental laws, that we haven't really changed the exposure of people of color in this country. In fact, recent work that I've been doing shows that using the last census, the 2010 census, that those exposures have actually increased. And so the question is why? Why is this continuing to happen? And Jill Harrison's chapter, I think, is fascinating because she does an ethnography of middle managers, people who are passionate about environmental justice at the EPA. And she really exposes, I think, to some extent, the not only the kind of personal prejudices and biases that middle managers will have, but also the kind of colorblind perspectives that they bring to environmental justice efforts, which are, I think, a real... which really have stymied the ability for the agency to push or be an advocate for communities of color. The other chapter I think that I really enjoy, or is I think really interesting, is the chapter on air quality in Long Beach. And the chapter is really interesting because it does talk about asthma and the exposure that Latinx communities have in Southern California. But it also spends a lot of time explaining the intersectionalities of this. So the multiple ways in which young children who are exposed to bad air impacts not just the children's health and development, but the family itself. And I already said this, but one of the early interesting things is the advancements that the author is making around air quality is that she's been able to show that these really micro-level particles that are being emitted by diesel fuel are not being detected by the instruments that we're using. In other words, we're being impacted by chemicals in the air that we're not measuring. So there's exposures that we have, or these communities in particular, are being exposed to that we're not even aware of yet. And again, that really is a fascinating chapter because it's really kind of just touching the, I think, the tip of the iceberg of all of these exposures that we as a population are being exposed to that we are not even measuring yet.
Great.
Which is kind of scary.
yeah, definitely. But hopefully everyone will check out the book and learn some more about that. So that brings us to our final question that we always ask all of our guests, which is, what are you working on next? What kind of projects are you taking up now that this book is out?
Well, so I am still writing this book on Flint and Detroit, and I'm looking at, and I'm calling it, I think, Thirsty for Environmental Justice, and it really looks at urban austerity and the way in which policies that have looked at sort of fiscal constraining of policies at the urban level in particular are a form of environmental justice for particular communities. You know, after the sort of Great Recession, many communities, particularly urban communities of color, were basically insolvent. You know, I think we've had 13 or 14 bankruptcies of municipal bankruptcies. So Vallejo and Stockton in California, and Detroit is the kind of most infamous one. But the book looks at the ways in which these policies. So it looks at the power of the way in which policies that are deemed to be economic policies, right? We're gonna cut the budgets of municipalities, are really policies that harm people of color. And what I want to show in this book is the ways in which communities of color like Flint and Detroit, who suffered from either lead poisoning of water, or in the Detroit's case, they had the highest, the largest outbreak of hepatitis A in the history of the United States as a result of water shutoffs, that these crises were actually A, man-made, B, were predictable, and sort of C, didn't have to happen. But also that what is going on in communities, not only in those, but communities like Milwaukee and Chicago and other sort of communities of color everywhere, is part of a larger kind of project that has to do with the privatization of public resources. And in particular, again, I'm looking at water. But the ways in which the privatization of these sort of public services are really harming people of color. In part because of the ways in which the Great Recession has really harmed these communities in terms of their ability to sort of weather some of these new fiscal crises. So I'm trying to show that what you see in these cities of color is a particular type of conjuncture coming together of environmental inequality and fiscal austerity. And what drives a lot of this reform, I argue, is sort of the racialization of some of these cities. So let me give you an example of that. In Detroit, the emergency manager was put in place to run the city. And the emergency manager came in and said, you know, Detroit, at least these, you know, Detroiters are basically, I think he called them something along the lines of lazy and might have called them dumb, lazy, and something, and a couple other things. The point is that the way in which austerity works is it blames it uses colorblind sort of jargon to blame people for the fiscal insolvency of the cities, when really, you know, it's not about black leadership or the inability for people of color to balance their budgets, but it's really about global capitalism and the ways in which de-investment and deindustrialization has really harmed a lot of these cities. And so, but what happens with kind of urban austerity policies and the way in which it's advanced, that it blames the communities for their own fiscal and financial problems. And in that sense, this kind of colorblind movement in these cities is a different form of environmental justice. It's not about correlating a toxic waste site with people of color. It's also about sort of financial insolvency and how that harms particular communities and advances sort of the investment and development in other communities, white suburbs, for example. So that's what I'm working on right now.
All right. Well, we'll be looking forward to that coming out, and maybe we'll have you back on the podcast once that book is finished. So Dr. Mascarenhas, thank you for coming on our show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And listeners, you just heard a conversation with Michael Mascarenhas, the editor of Lessons in Environmental Justice, From Civil Rights to Black Lives Matter and Idle No More, published this year by Sage.